Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Welcome to The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined, as always, by Bruce Feldman. It was a pretty uneventful Saturday for Week 5. You knew that was coming eventually. But man, we could have had one of the biggest upsets of, probably the biggest upset of the year. It came down to a two-point conversion. North Carolina goes for two. Clemson stops it. The Tigers survive as a 27-point favorite, Bruce. Clemson dropped to number two in the AP and coaches polls on Sunday. They were number one, obviously, since the preseason. What's going on with our Clemson Tigers?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, I feel like I expect no one to touch them in the ACC or in the conference title game. But Clemson definitely were on the ropes with Mac Brown's team and a true freshman quarterback, Sam Howell. And here's the question that I pose to you. I think Trevor Lawrence looked fantastic, especially against Alabama in the national title game, and people were raving about him. I'm going to throw some numbers at you, and I know stats can be for losers, and maybe you and I are them and whatnot. And I'm not saying Trevor Lawrence isn't a terrific quarterback, because I think he is. But so far, basically in the first month of the season, 8 touchdowns, 5 picks. He's actually thrown more picks so far than he did all of last year, including in the playoff. Last year, 30 touchdowns, 4 picks. This year, 8 touchdowns and 5 picks. He's actually 6th in the ACC, which is hardly a league loaded with quarterbacks, in quarterback rating, just in the ACC alone. I don't think this is obviously reason for panic, but what is up with him?
Yeah, when he had kind of a rough game against Syracuse, but they still won the game decisively, there was a little bit of, is something wrong with Trevor Lawrence, but it seemed too early to go there. Well, at this point, we have 5 games, and while people, you know, while guys like Tua and Jalen Hurts and Joe, like these guys are putting up huge numbers, his are very pedestrian. And if you watched the game Saturday, and it's always hard to say how much of it is the quarterback and how much of it is the pieces around him, because it was surprising to see UNC's defense get as much pressure on him as they did. In particular, Chaz Surratt, the guy. What an inspired move, by the way. Whoever, I assume it was Jay Bateman, their DC, decided that the former starting quarterback would be better as a linebacker. He's phenomenal, and he was in his face constantly. And so, yeah, he's struggling. There's no question about it. I don't think he forgot how to play quarterback since last year, but something's going on. And, you know, we talked about this a little bit offline, but it reminds you a little bit of, I would say, a couple situations recently. Jameis Winston comes off his Heisman Trophy season, and the next year he's throwing interceptions like crazy, and Florida State's struggling to beat some teams that it had no business, you know, they should have blown away. And then if you remember, after Ohio State's national title season in 2014, well, of course, there was that great mystery about which guy was going to be the quarterback between Cardale Jones and JT Barrett. But that team was loaded, and week after week, their offense wouldn't look good, and it was a mystery. It seemed like they had regressed. Now, I'm not ready to go there quite yet. They've only had this one scare, but I wonder if there's something akin to that going on.
Yeah, I don't see the comparison to Ohio State, just because I don't think the quarterback was, you know, JT Barrett is a talented college quarterback, but he wasn't anywhere near what we think of as Trevor Lawrence as a quarterback prospect. Jameis, to me, and granted, look, Jameis had a lot of issues that made him very polarizing off the field because he had a lot of significant issues around him. Trevor Lawrence hasn't had those. Trevor Lawrence has really good skill guys around him. Now, we know that some of the O linemen, Mitch Hyatt, who was a fixture there for so long, he's not there anymore. Tremaine Ankrum still is there, though, on the other side. I don't know. I'll be honest, and I'd be lying if I said I've spent a lot of time either studying Clemson or around them this year. I just haven't. And the way, in full disclosure, the way my TV schedule's worked out is I've almost seen none of them live. Now, I've seen some watching it back, but just to see it in real time, I really haven't. I mean, they played a Thursday night game when we had a Thursday night game, and this game they had the other day went on when we were on the field. So I didn't see it in real time, but it's a little bit of a head scratcher. Now, having said all that, you know, I think we know better than to jump off bandwagons and get too stats crazy. But at what point, and maybe it's after a loss or something, if somebody does upset them, do you have to reassess it? Because, and here's where I'm going with this, for a lot of folks, us included, the default was, oh, it's going to be Clemson and Alabama. Those are clearly the two best teams. What we're seeing, and what we certainly saw on Saturday night on the road when Ohio State went to Nebraska, Ryan Day's team is looking very impressive. Now, they haven't beaten anybody really of note, but they have just been dominant. And to me, that's got to carry some weight. So I haven't looked at your top 10. Where do you factor the Buckeyes in now, and how do you evaluate Clemson and Alabama, who quite honestly haven't played anybody of substance either, and they haven't looked quite the level that the way the Buckeyes have.
You know, my top 10 went up Saturday night. It's now Monday morning, so you know, you've had some time to catch up on
it. I had two stories to write. I had a baseball game.
And my forward pass Monday morning was all about this topic, but you know, no offense. No offense taken. I know, we're all busy. So Ohio State's my number one team. They were number two going into the week, and after the Nebraska, you know, beatdown they did, yeah, number one team. And I think there's no magic point where you say, all right, we got to throw out preseason at this point, whether that's week two or week four or week eight, whatever somebody would say. But I think it's time. Now, you know what's interesting? A great stat from Matt Brown, one of our editors who does the Inside the Ballot every Sunday. He's our AP voter. This is the first time in 50 years, Bruce, 50, that the six teams that started the preseason 1-6 are the same teams at the end of September. Order has changed a little bit, but it's the same six teams. But to your point that going into the season, everybody thought it's Alabama, Clemson, you know, they're destined to play again in the national championship. I don't know how you could say that after a month of the season. I think all six of those teams, Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, Georgia, Ohio State, Oklahoma are all in the mix. And
you're missing somebody, Stu. Somebody is deserving to be in that mix. Actually, two teams, but one especially to me is like, hey, we got to take these guys seriously now. You know who that is?
Auburn?
That's Auburn.
Yeah.
All right. So look, they didn't look great in the first half against Justin Herbert and Oregon, but they ended up winning that game. They got a nasty defense. They blew out Tulane. Obviously, Tulane's not great, but Tulane's improved. Destroyed Kent, and then went to A&M, won that game, and then I thought they just absolutely, if you were watching two screens and you watch what Ohio State was doing, what they did to Mississippi State, I mean, they just embarrassed them. Now, they got to go to Florida this weekend. If they win that game, I think they should be the number one team in the country.
Interesting.
Regardless of what else happens. What's up?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think if you were doing a straight-up resume ranking right now, no eye tests, no preconceived notions, resume only, Auburn would be number one, in large part because of that Oregon win. I don't think Texas A&M is very good, but they did beat them on the road. So, and now they're going to add Florida, which is just part of this brutal schedule that they're playing this year. They've still got you know, LSU, Alabama, and Georgia to come after that. You know, the question to me going into this past week still with them was Bo Nix, and you know, he had the game-winning touchdown against Oregon, but on the whole, you know, was still seen pretty limited as a passer. Well, he had his breakout game the other night against Mississippi State. They've got a good running game. They look like, you know, when Gus Malzahn has his best teams, the running game is lethal, and that opens up the passing game. And it is starting to look like that, to go with a very good defense. So this is a big one Saturday at Florida. You and I have been down on Florida compared to certainly the polls where they're in the top 10, but that Kyle Trask change up, you know, when Felipe Franks went down, so far he's looked great. We'll see how he plays against the Sovereign defense.
Yeah, I talked to Joe Moorhead for a little bit this weekend, the Mississippi State coach, and he coached in the Big Ten and faced Ohio State with obviously a very fierce defensive line. And this Auburn group, he said, is about as good as he's seen. I mean, he was really came away impressed with what they've got there. So I'm interested to see how Florida does. Like we said, it's in Gainesville. That's not an easy place to play. This is a rebuilt Gators offensive line. Good luck going against Derek Brown and company. That Derek Brown is a phenomenal player. So excited about that one.
Let's talk a little bit more about – can we talk a little bit more about Ohio State?
We can. But before that, the other team I was alluding to that I think deserves to be in the discussion of not just the six, maybe there's eight, would be Wisconsin. I think they're deserving. Let's jump in on the Buckeyes. You were something of a skeptic, unfortunately, because you had read what I think is way too much into a spring game
on TV. Guilty on that about, one.
Yeah, you really blew that. And so that's a lesson to be learned. The quarterback there who came from Georgia, and I noticed this a little bit from both from people texting me and also on Twitter, saying, could you believe that Georgia let him go instead of, what were they going to do? So give me your read on it. I mean, Jake Fromm's a terrific college quarterback, but what you see right now at Ohio State is as good a running quarterback, because he's bigger than anything Urban Meyer's had since Tebow, and more athletic than Tebow, or at least faster, and probably with a better arm. This is impressive what Ryan Day has got in this offense right now.
Justin Fields is fantastic, and I would like to apologize to him for doubting him based off of a performance I saw in the spring game. Like you said,
you should apologize to the Audible listeners for
I apologize to the Audible listeners for doubting Justin Fields. But the notion that Georgia should have benched Jake Fromm and started him instead is ludicrous. You're not going to bench. I mean, I was looking at Mel Kiper did his new big board, which, by the way, the top 10 is like almost all Alabama and Ohio State players. Jake Fromm is in the first round. You're not, so he may
what
not
does
be.
What does that mean, though?
He may not be this.
What does that mean?
It means that there's no realistic scenario where Kirby Smart was going to bench his future first round quarterback who led them to the national championship game for the hotshot freshman. Now,
are you sure? So, do we know that he's really going to be a first round? Maybe he will, but I mean,
yeah,
I wouldn't
nobody knows
that
for
as
sure.
Your benchmark. That's right.
But he's a pretty good. I don't know if you're suddenly dogging Jake Fromm. That guy's pretty good. He may also be a better fit for that offense than Justin Fields, even though Justin Fields is clearly the perfect fit for what Ryan Day is doing. Why? Maybe the story should just be that it worked out well for both of them.
That's fair. I mean, look, we've seen plenty of examples of things where somebody has to be at fault, and maybe you're right on that.
Yeah, I think that he's a great fit, and J.K. Dobbins is the number three running back in the country right now, so it's not like he's the whole offense. But I really think the story of Ohio State so far this season is the defense. Because last season, you remember, it was a mystery all season why they were giving up. I mean, you remember the Purdue game. Rondell Moore went off on them. The Maryland game where they gave up 51 points. Nebraska, a year before this drubbing the other day, Nebraska gave them fits. They were just not good on defense last year. There's no way around it.
Yeah, and what it comes back to from talking to people there is probably too complicated trying to do too much X and O's wise. And I think especially Jeff Hafley, that's the co-DC, and he's the secondary guy, and that's where they've gotten significantly better. I think the adjustments he's made and some of the real fundamental stuff, and it's worth noting, Greg Schiano was the defensive coordinator. Jeff Hafley is a Greg Schiano protege, worked for him at Rutgers, went with him to Tampa Bay when they went to the Bucks. He's really had a big impact. They are not giving up the big plays. They are way more buttoned up in what they do, and they just go play fast, and we're seeing it. And look, I think it's also worth noting, right now, Chase Young is every bit the dominator that Bosa was going to be last year, but Bosa didn't really play last year. He played like the first two games and then had the groin injury that really shut him down. So I think you add the development of Chase Young to what's already a pretty stacked front seven, plus the improved secondary, and it's been lights out. I think what's interesting here is Ryan Day, who coached there three games, and everybody was a believer in Ryan Day. But I wonder, because of all the, and I know you were a skeptic last year, and I'm not taking issue with it, because of all the drama that was swirling around Ohio State football last year, that it seemed to have taken a toll on them. Now, they look really good in the last two games of the season, but there was just a lot of clutter to deal with. And I don't think they have that right now, and they're just playing, they're not only scheme-wise playing free, it just seems like they are just very business-like and not having to deal with a lot of stuff. It's just a lot of stuff. There was obviously all the mess from the Zach Smith scandal, and there was the fallout. Urban Meyer suspended for three games. Then I think, and I don't know how much of this factored into the team, but you also had Urban's health issues, which became a front burner issue because there was a lot of video of it and of his job prospects or how long he was going to coach. I think you'd throw in there on top of that, there was the random kind of crazy story, whether it was Zach Smith out to get Tom Herman or, you know, I don't even know what we want to call it. It was kind of that wild, I would say, unfounded race story that the players had to kind of navigate. It's just, there was a lot of stuff that they dealt with. And right now they're not having to worry about or deal with any of that.
Yeah, I think those are the kind of things that you don't necessarily pick up on in real time, but with the benefit of hindsight, how could they not have been affected by all that drama? But they kept winning. They kept, you know, they ended up 13-1 and they won the Big Ten and they won the Rose Bowl. So in the end, you could say it all worked out, but in real time, also the staff dynamics where, okay, Ryan Day is the head coach now, so clearly, and he's doing great. But at the time that he was promoted, when Urban was suspended, there were a lot of people who were like, well, wait a minute, why did they pick him when you've got Greg Schiano sitting there who was a college head coach for 11 years? You also had Alex Grinch came in for 1 year. You know, I'm not sure what effect that may or may not have had. You've got Kevin Wilson. He was also a former head coach. There was a lot going on there last year. And, you know, I think you see there, but talent was never really the question. Nobody was sitting there going, gosh, you know, Ohio State stinks on defense now. They must really not be recruiting well anymore. No. You know, Chase Young's going to be a high first-round pick. Jeffrey Okudo's kind of been the breakout so far this season. He had two interceptions the other night. They intercepted Adrian Martinez on three of the first four possessions. So all of this is a way of saying, yeah, I get it. Ohio State's played a light schedule. And as we know in college football, every week's a new season. They play Michigan State this week. Michigan State's got a good defense. Maybe they'll do, you know, they'll shut them down in a way that other teams haven't. I don't know. But if you're basing your rankings based on what you've seen through the first 5 weeks, no question they've been the most dominant team.
How much stock are you putting into the rebuilt Michigan State offense? Brian Mulroney, 10 touchdowns, one pick. Are you buying them?
No, I'm not, because I actually watched the end. Indiana could have won that game. It was yet another. I feel like I've watched this Indiana football game a million times. They came close. They almost pulled it off. But yeah, no, I'm not buying Michigan State. And I think that they may hold down Ohio State's offense, but they're not going to do much. They're not going to score much against the Buckeyes. Hey, Greg Schiano, we already mentioned his name. We've already had our first head coach firing in college football. It came on September 29th. Rutgers fires Chris Ash. I think we all knew that was coming at some point. It's just been dreadful, even by Rutgers standards, over the last year and a half or so. And so that obviously leads to the immediate speculation. Well, there's a guy sitting out there who is the only coach in modern history to have success at Rutgers, who actually, you know, for that rare moment in time, had Rutgers the number 7 team in the country in 2006, and he's not currently coaching, and that's Schiano. And I'm sure there'll be a coaching search that takes place, and many names will get mentioned, but it seems to me, and I know you wrote about this on Sunday, and I read the article, by the way, that it's his to lose. It's his if he wants it.
Yeah, look, so as you said, Rutgers was horrible before he got there. They had won 11 games in the previous 5 years. And Schiano, it took a little time to build, but he made them very respectable. And I think the biggest thing he did was he gave them a real presence in the Northeast.
And that has since really dwindled and gone away. I mean, I think people forget Kyle Flood actually won 8 games in Rutgers' first season in the Big Ten. The divisions were different, and that's not insignificant because right now they're in as hard a division as there is in college football, with the possible exception of the SEC West. So there's that. And then it's just backslid under Chris Ash. Greg Schiano, I don't know if he wants to come back and be a coach again, especially at that level or not. He's been through a lot. We all know about the mess at Tennessee where he's accepted the job, and then all of a sudden there's this innuendo, and it just gets spiraled out of control into this fan revolt and just kind of grease fire and all over, honestly, some third-party BS. But right now, I don't know if he wants to jump back. But if he does, keep in mind, Rutgers' biggest booster is somebody who's always been very close to him. And I think there's a lot of people there. Now, he did step on some toes at times because he's not a small personality there. But in terms of big picture and getting it, and in terms of getting the alignment in the state of New Jersey, because that is a really good football state. I don't know if a lot of people realize just how much talent comes out of New Jersey. But he would be the guy if he wants it. Now, if he doesn't, the hunch is that they just had a unproven coordinator get the job, and it obviously did not work out at all with Chris Ash. So do they go try to get somebody similar to Schiano who has experience and at that level and go hire Butch Jones? I think he's a real candidate if Schiano doesn't want it. He obviously did well at Cincinnati and Central Michigan and had an up and down run, but obviously did better than what was before him and what was after him at Tennessee. I could see them trying to reach out to a Jason Candle who's at Toledo. That would be obviously a step up for him. A wild card in this, I think, is Joe Moorhead, who's a Northeast guy who did really well in the Big Ten as an offensive coordinator at Penn State. I don't know if he would make the leap from Mississippi State to Rutgers necessarily, but it is back in familiar ground in the Northeast, and he's now very experienced in what it's like to coach in a division where you're one of the have-nots in a really group that's loaded with powerhouses. The thing that I wonder here is, because Mike Elko is a name that I think could get some traction, and he's a Northeast guy from Brunswick, New Jersey, and as somebody explained it to me, now he's never been a head coach, but I think it's more important for them to have a guy with real ties in New Jersey than it is necessarily to have a guy with head coaching experience. Now, if you can have both, great. But I think where it really became an uphill battle for Chris Ash was he just really was never to get alignment or any traction in that state. And in that state, it really does matter. I mean, Schiano was a Rutgers guy. He understood the state and he made it work. After that, it's kind of backslid. And it's a tough job, but again, I think he would make a lot of sense if he wants it there.
It's an extremely tough job. I agree. I think you got to have somebody that knows Jersey. And if Schiano doesn't want it, all I would say is, first of all, I don't have a great pulse of the Rutgers fan base. Of, you know, I think a lot of them want Schiano back. I don't know if it's universal. But if they don't get him, I just can't imagine the letdown if that ends up turning to, hey, we're thrilled today to introduce Butch Jones as the next head coach of Rutgers after he just completely flamed out at Tennessee. I know he had success at Cincinnati, an initial success at Tennessee. Didn't they go 0-8 in the SEC his last year?
They did, but they also, he did have him in the top 25 in the 2 years before that.
I think that would be a hard sell. And Mike Elko sounds good, but if I'm Mike Elko, I would stay at A&M and make $2 million a year to be the defensive coordinator, then go take that job where, let's be honest, it's one of those jobs where if you take that job, you know, I know every guy thinks he has confidence in himself, and rightfully so, and should think that he's going to be the one to turn around. But I don't know. If I were taking the head coaching job at Rutgers, I might want to have a backup plan in place for 4 years from then, because it's such an uphill battle that they're going to
face. So who do you think would, if it's not Schiano, who do you think they would like? Who you think would be well received hire?
That I don't have a great answer, because I don't know if the bar to be well received may be higher than what's realistic, right? Like, yeah, Mike Elko, I mean, would be very well received. Would he want to take it? I don't know.
I don't know. He could wait another year, and probably there'll probably be a lot more job openings. From everything I've heard from talking to people inside the business, there will probably be a lot more vacancies coming off in 2020 than there are now. But
you know who's a Jersey guy? Oklahoma State offensive coordinator Sean Gleason. But I don't think he's necessarily ready for that yet. But he is the coach right now of Chuba Hubbard, who ran for almost 300 yards the other day. So we'll see if that could be even remotely a possibility. We were recording this on Monday morning, and there was some breaking news shortly before we came on the podcast. Not surprising this was going to happen at some point, but it is still a big deal that the state of California passed the Fair Pay to Play Act, which, if it goes into effect as it's supposed to in 2023, would prohibit colleges and the NCAA from keeping athletes from making money off their name, image, and likeness. Obviously, the NCAA is opposing it. They have threatened to kick the California schools out of the NCAA. Obviously, it would not be ideal if one state had different rules than the others, but realistically, I mean, there's already other states that are proposing similar bills. The NCAA is going to have to do something. They formed a task force in October. I mean, sorry, they formed a task force that's supposed to put forth recommendations in October. But at the end of the day, Gavin Newsom, governor of California, signed the bill after unanimous. When do you ever see a piece of legislation go through two legislative bodies unanimously? And then in kind of a, I don't know what it says exactly, but 2019, here we are. They did this not in some formal bill signing ceremony at the Capitol, but in fact, he did it on LeBron James' barbershop show.
Okay, so, and it's interesting because this is obviously coming out of California, but there is some support with other states have been pushing some other legislation similar to this. So I don't think it's necessarily a blue state, red state issue from my read on some of the other things surrounding it, correct?
It seems to be the only issue in America where both parties are 100% on board with it, at least in the states that have taken it up so far.
Okay, so let me ask you this, because my Twitter feed is chock full of what I feel like things are drifting into hot take territory from a lot of former college athletes who are now in the media. I have my opinions on this, and I'll get to it in a minute, but what is your initial read on good thing or bad thing for college sports?
So it's, I mean, good thing, and it's something that I've been, you know, this has been many, many years in the making. The Ed O'Bannon case that it got decided in 2014, but I think it started 5 years before that, was all about name, image, and likeness. And the NCAA has tried to confuse people intentionally into thinking that this is the same thing as pay for play, where, you know, this is even Pac-12 put out a statement in response to this Monday about how this is going to professionalize college sports. And none of this is going to require the schools themselves to put the athletes on payroll and make them employees and pay them a salary. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about, okay, if, you know, car dealership in Clemson, South Carolina wants to pay Trevor Lawrence to do commercials for them, he can do that and not have it ruin his eligibility. You know, we could come up with a million other examples like that. Most notably, the EA Sports NCAA football game that was a casualty of all this and that a lot of people want to see come back. And they've said flat out they'd be happy to do it if they are allowed to pay the athletes to be in the game, because they got sued and had to pay a big settlement over that. So I think it's a good thing. I do recognize that there are consequences. There are that you can't even necessarily possibly see coming. And a lot of things are going to have to be ironed out between now and 2023, when this is supposed to go into effect. But, you know, the people like myself, and I've been kind of a moderate voice on it compared to Jay Billis and many others. And this is all we've been saying for years. It's the Olympic model. You know, the Olympic athletes, there's no employer that's paying them to go compete in the Olympics, but they can make money from sponsors. And that's what we're talking about here for college sports.
So here's a dumbed down version of this. And I've heard this from people, and I talked to one college administrator probably about 2 weeks ago, and this came up, this part of it, maybe not in the language I'm going to use it in, but does this mean the bag man can be legal? What do you think about that?
To some extent, yes. And that's the thing for the people.
There's not to some extent. It is, I think this, forget to some extent. I think this does open that possibility wide open.
Yeah, so I just saw some people, you know, the number one blowback I saw on Twitter Monday morning was, well, this is going to just destroy competitive balance. All the rich schools with all the rich boosters are going to be, you know, buying recruit. This is going to be their way. Well, it's already happening, you know. I don't think the recruiting rankings will look any differently in 2023 than they do now, because those same schools that are dominating recruiting now are the ones that have the boosters and the bagmen that can have the means and the interest to do that.
Let's talk about cheating for a second while we're here.
Sure.
This might be interesting. A couple of things that go on that are almost impossible to prove, but you hear about it a lot when you talk to coaches and recruiting folks inside the business, inside college football. There's all sorts of ways that people have come up with workarounds beyond just the guy who looks like he has the Moonlight Graham bag and just drops it off or something.
The guy from Blue Chips.
Or something like that. I think there are things, everything from what you hear about now is the online poker game where somebody is told, don't fold and you'll win a bunch of money. There's been a lot of layers to what boosters and I think some folks within the college football world have conjured up
casino chips things completely casino untraceable
chips. A lot of this is untraceable. Look, there's things I heard about last year with a top recruit where one assistant coach was trying to work something out where some boosters at his school would fund a business from that this family was trying to get off the ground. I don't know how well you'd be able to, you know, the NCAA would be able to police that. Now, that kid didn't even go to that school. There's some other layers of this where it is parents getting jobs, moving to wherever the kid goes to play.
Well, that's an important point, because I do think that a lot of the stuff, and we saw this in the college basketball trials, right? Almost all of the money that was being doled out to the families, not to the player himself. So if nothing else, this would create a legal means for the guys who are actually throwing the passes and hitting the three-pointers to be the ones making the money rather than hooking up a parent with a job somewhere or you know, what Cecil Newton was alleged to be trying to do back during Cam Newton's recruitment. There's a lot to sort out. I'm not saying it's going to all work out very cleanly, but I think at the end of the day, these are still people with, you know, we're talking about people with businesses, and businesses have to make money and they have to be smart and they have to turn a profit. It would be, I can't think of any business for which it would be smart, no matter how rabid a booster you are, to give all 25 kids in the signing class or all 85 players on the roster $20,000 each. You know, it's going to be like in any walk of life, the guys who are in the most demand, Trevor Lawrence, Tua, Jalen Hurts, Chase Young, are going to probably make some considerable money off this. But most of the guys in the locker room are not. And you can talk about the effects of that and whether that would be bad for locker room chemistry or whatnot. But I think that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about everybody in college athletics is going to get rich. Those people who have the name recognition to basically be influencers, literally influencers like on Instagram, and probably they will become Instagram influencers, will be able to make that money just like anybody in any other walk of life can.
Do you feel more comfortable that this would now be above board as opposed to the kind of thing that gets whispered around if you go talk to coaches and different things?
I don't think you could ever completely root out cheating. You know, people who want, who
it's
don't
human
care
nature.
About,
it's yeah, human nature.
People who don't care about the rules
people,
are going to do that. But I guess the question would be, is there as much of a need to do that right? Like if people can openly pay the best recruits, what could you give on top of that underground that would like seal the deal, you know? So I think it would, I don't think it would go away, but there'd be less incentive. You know, the stuff that went on in basketball with the shoe companies, I mean, technically speaking, the shoe companies could now just sign endorsement deals with the guys. I don't think that would be very smart to do that with too many guys in football because they're 3 years at least away from becoming professional athletes, but theoretically they could do that.
Okay. Well, I'm curious if some of our listeners also can give us some feedback into our mailbag for next week. Not necessarily just questions, maybe, but just what you think of it. Because I feel like one of the things that comes out is there's a lot of like stuff that's over the top that you're seeing from former athletes who are weighing in, and it goes to all ends of the spectrum. But I don't know if you often hear a ton from fans about it.
Yeah, I would send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com because I will fully acknowledge that the echo chamber on Twitter of sports writers who seem to be 98% about athletes need to get paid, what an injustice this is not reflective of the larger population. And in fact, most polls I have seen, it's still like a slight majority that are against athletes making money, college athletes making money. Now, I don't know how many of those polls have made a point of distinguishing between pay for play and NIL. That would probably be hard to really sum up in a poll. But, you know, I mean, I can remember in the O'Bannon case, they put up the NCAA as an exhibit, put up some polling that showed that majority of the public, at least in 2014, thought college athletes should be amateurs. So it would be good to hear from everybody listening.
Before we move on, one quick thing. I had noticed you had commented that about how the NCAA is reacting, and I don't know if it's fair to say what they did is starting to already a spin campaign about it, but that seemed to have something. Am I reading too much into what you thought about it?
Yeah, the NCAA is terrified, and they and so you know they sent a letter saying that you know, and trying to get them. They mostly wanted California to hold off on signing this bill until their own committee is supposed to issue recommendations in late October. But I saw Gavin Newsom say today that he asked for them to just give him some sort of indication of what was coming, and they couldn't do it. They are spinning this like crazy. And it was actually the Pac-12 is the one I pointed out. They put out a statement on Monday morning because it's pretty short. Here was the Pac-12 statement Monday morning on the signing of California SB 206. The Pac-12 is disappointed in the passage of SB 206 and believes it will have a very significant negative consequence for our student athletes and broader universities in California. The legislation will lead to the professionalization of college sports, and many unintended consequences related to this professionalism. Imposes a state law that conflicts with national rules, will blur the lines for how California universities recruit student athletes to compete nationally, and will likely reduce resources and opportunities for student athletes in Olympic sports, and have a negative impact on female student athletes. When I refer to spin, I'm referring to that, because again, we're talking about third-party companies possibly paying college athletes. There's no reason why that would have any impact on whether a female swimmer is going to get a scholarship or not. So they're just trying to muddy the waters and confuse everybody in an attempt to basically sell public opinion that this is bad for college sports.
Okay. Before we get to the mailbag, a couple other points to touch on. Stu, I don't know if you got to see our Washington USC game on Saturday. The Huskies won 28-14.
I saw it, but I had to I'm a Dish Network customer, and all of a sudden on Thursday, I think, Dish dropped Fox and FS1 and the Big Ten Network, so I had to scramble a little bit to be able to watch your game and sign up for a free trial of one of the streaming services. But I did it. I worked it around.
So I have a column right now up on The Athletic about, after being around USC for the past couple weeks and being inside with them and seeing them up close and talking to a lot of people in the program, kind of the reality of what I see with them, the good, the bad, and all the things related to Clay Helton and his job prospects. They have a bye week this week before they get to go to South Bend to play Notre Dame.
I suspect, I don't know this for a fact, but they played without Keaton Slovis, who's a really talented young quarterback who got hurt at the beginning of the Utah game, and Talanoa Hufanga, who's probably the best player in the program. He's definitely the best player on their defense. He was in the concussion protocol. Now, both players were there in Seattle, and I was able to see them before the game, but them getting back helps them. I suspect if there's such thing as a must-win for, even though it's not a conference game, for if Clay Helton has any chance of keeping his job, I suspect that is the biggest must-win he could have. What do you make of the USC situation right now? As they're in this bye week, they're kind of where we thought they'd be at 3-2. It's just they got there a little differently by beating Utah and losing to BYU.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I would have guessed before the season that they would be fortunate to be 4-2 coming out of the Notre Dame game, and that's exactly where they are. But because of the quarterback injuries, it's almost like I personally have given Clay Helton a little bit more of a pass because he lost both his starting quarterback and then the freshman who replaced the starting quarterback, and I think that that's a pretty big, you know, mitigating circumstance. But I also concede that USC fans aren't going to care. You know, let's say they lose to Notre Dame and they're 3-3. It's hard to see a scenario where they would then go on to have the kind of season that would justify him keeping the job. I think it's a done deal. I you know, unless they beat Notre Dame, which would obviously be a big win, and then run the table from there so that they win the Pac-12 and would at 11-2 at least be in consideration for the playoff. And that's not going to happen. So, you know, I just assume that he's kind of playing out the string. But they could certainly win the Pac-12 South now that they have the tiebreaker over Utah. Like, this team can accomplish things. I just don't think it's going to be enough to save his job.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote this in the column. I think he's made some really good improvements, especially since that Notre Dame game, in terms of how he is running the program. It's he has no margin for error left, and I think it's going to look like it's too little too late. And I agree with you. I mean, to play with a third string quarterback and without your best player on top of that, and a tough place to play against a good team, and they played hard. I think there's very few teams in the country that would have gone in there and beating Utah one week and then go beat Washington on the road. I don't know how many teams, besides maybe Alabama and maybe Clemson, I would expect to be able to beat those two teams with their third string quarterback and really depleted on defense. But coming back to it, I just don't know if he's going to be able to do enough to convince the people who need to be convinced, yeah, he should be the coach going forward in 2020 and beyond. I just don't know if that's really doable. Maybe beating Notre Dame will at least get him some momentum, but I think that ship is starting to sail away. And you know, again, I'm interested to see how they respond after this bye week, but it was interesting to be around this program for the last couple of weeks and see it, because I think so many people assume he's completely done, and they don't. In fairness to him and the players, they don't comport themselves like a group that is mailing it in and thinks they have no chance. That's not how, to their credit, that's not how the Trojans and those players have handled it.
I think that's important to just in general. You know, people, we're out here, we're on Twitter, we're in social media, we're on podcasts debating this guy's job. Unless it's a really extreme situation and Charlie Strong's last days at Texas come to mind, that's not what's going on inside the football building, inside the locker room, and on the practice field. Those guys are going about their season as if they want to win a championship. They're not debating whether Clay Helton's the right guy for the job, and if not, who should they hire? And I think because you've been around the team so closely, you're seeing that. You're seeing what life is really like for USC football right now, which is a lot different than what's going on Ryan Abraham's message board on his USCfootball.com site. So, you know, I have noticed all the same improvements you have. We'll see what they can do. That Utah win was huge because I really think it's going to come down to the two of them. Utah had a nice bounce back win against Washington State in the Pac-12 South. Speaking of which, your guy Mike Leach. So The Athletic, and this is was by no means intentional, we have written a lot of stories, good stories, amusing stories in the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 months about that have demonstrated like Mike Leach and all his very unique way of doing things. In particular, I'm thinking of Jason Jenks interviewing all his former quarterbacks about what exactly goes on in that meeting room. But, you know, Mike Leach, just after blowing that huge lead against UCLA, they go and they get their butts kicked by Utah the other day. They only scored 13 points. And afterward, made some waves by describing his players as fat, dumb, happy, and entitled. And that is, by the way, not the first time he's used the word fat in a quote when he was unhappy with his team. I'm thinking back to Texas Tech, though in that case, I believe the quote was fat girlfriends, right?
Yeah, there was also some other stuff early on in his tenure at Washington State that kind of went in a similar direction. I mean, look, I've done a couple of, and full disclosure, I co-wrote Leach's book, you know, 10 years ago, but I've done a couple of these stories where I think you get to see his personality and he's quirky and everybody, almost everybody at least, seems to really get into these just offbeat things that he says and everything like that. The part that when I heard this is you kind of scratch your head and say, you know, whether Leach says, okay, and we got out coach too, when he speaks in such colorful language about fat, soft, and all that stuff, where it's tied into what those players are, I think it ends up going viral. Where if he's included the part, yeah, and we got Al coach too, I don't think it rises to the same level. And as some people I talked to who worked with Leach before pointed out, and this is the first time I'd probably ever heard this expression, which you'll hear in football and you'll probably hear in sports a lot. You're either coaching it or allowing it to happen. I would hear that Leach was the first person I ever heard that. And basically the inference is the buck stops with the head coach and the coaches. Because before you point the finger at your players for what they did on Saturday, it's on you that you didn't get it fixed or you didn't have them ready, you know. And so for all of Leach's colorful comments, and including some of the time he's tweeting some you know, interesting and colorful things and deep thought things, you know, he likes the attention as well. But when the team does not produce like that, it's more on him than it is as much on him, if not more, than it is on anybody else. And I can see why people point out the hypocrisy in that.
It's all fun and games until you lose 38-13, right? I think we both agree he's a really good coach. He's done things at both Texas Tech and Washington State that they hadn't done in a long time. But they also are very inconsistent. They have never had that, you know, season where everything comes together. That last year was the closest at Washington State that he's had with Gardner Minshew. We all now see just how good that guy is. But then they laid an egg against Washington in the Apple Cup. So, you know, it's all well and good. I mean, that story I was referencing, basically you read that and you wonder how they ever win a game, because it seems like he doesn't actually do any coaching in the quarterback meeting rooms, but they have won a lot of games. Then stuff like this happens, and, you know, if you're going to blame the players, if you're going to throw them under the bus like that, then, yeah, I think it's the media's responsibility to hold them accountable and say, well, what about the coaching? You clearly didn't have that team ready, which, by the way, is what almost every coach you hear after a bad loss, they say, that's on me. I didn't have those guys prepared to play. Even if that's not actually really what happened, it's just kind of the responsible thing to do because they're college athletes. And yeah, you want to light a fire under them sometime, but calling them fat and whatever is not, I don't know. I'm not on board with that. I don't think that's the right way to go about it.
Okay, let's get to the mailbag, Stu. Yes.
As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com.
We're going to start here with Ben Long. Bruce and Stu, any inside scoop on what's happening at Virginia Tech? Is this their new ceiling, or is Justin Fuente just a bad fit? It's painful to watch. As Ben is referencing, Duke whipped them on Thursday night. And was it Friday night or Thursday night? Whatever it was ugly. and it's gotten ugly in Blacksburg. Should there be panic, or should there just be a shoulder shrug still?
I think there should be panic, because basically their record has gotten worse every year he's been there. Last year they had to reschedule, you know, find a cupcake that they could beat in a rescheduled game to be able to keep their bowl streak alive. This year's team, it started off with a loss to BC. That wasn't good. Then they beat two nobodies, and then they get their butts kicked at home by Duke. This team is probably not going to a bowl game. And the thing is, we keep hearing about, oh, it was the leftovers from the Frank Beamer era, and they've had a bunch of transfers, guys who weren't buying in. Well, that would make more sense in year one or year two. This is now mostly his, almost entirely his own roster. It's year four, and they're just getting worse by the year. So that tells me that this is much more of a Justin Fuente problem than a end of Frank Beamer era problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to give him a little more. We've seen coaches get fired after 3 years. I think it's hard to do that if it's a guy who's already proven himself as a first-time head coach. Yes, that's where I'm going. So, again, I think that he did a really good job at Memphis. He had a really nice first year coming up off of following a legend there in Frank Beamer. I don't know what direction. I think you want to see what happens over the next 2 months. You're right. They're going to be lucky to get to a bowl game. But you want to see how competitive the players are going to be, because a lot of the guys they're going to rely on over the next 2 months are guys that they're going to have really be core guys in 2020, 21, no matter who's the coach there. So I'm interested to see what happens now that they've been pounded and embarrassed. How does the team respond to that? Because you certainly have a program in flux. This is the last year for Bud Foster there, the great defensive coordinator. He's obviously stepping down. It was announced before the season. So you want to see, okay, what kind of building blocks are here? What kind of foundation does Justin Fuente have there? And I'm interested to see, because, you know, getting back to Ben's question, I don't think this is the new ceiling. I mean, Virginia Tech is in a really good recruiting base. It has some great football history. There's a lot to sell there. It's got to be better than this. There's no way that's the new ceiling. I mean, it's just a matter of, can Justin Fuente get it going there?
Do you think, in hindsight, at the time it was really lauded as a great way to transition, was keep Bud Foster. He could be help segue from the Beamer era to the new era. And there were other guys behind the scenes that they kept as well. Do you think, in hindsight, he should have just made a clean break?
I don't know. I mean, that's hard for me to say. I'm really not in the middle of it. I mean, they have gotten worse every year, from 10 wins to 9 wins to 6 wins. And now, as you said, they're going to be lucky to make a bowl.
Yeah, if I had to guess, it'd be like 4-8.
I just don't know. I mean, if you pull the plug, I mean, you know, how does that get received if you force Bud Foster out of there after he's been such a backbone guy in Blacksburg to that program? I don't know how you do that.
I mean, yeah, I don't think it would have gone over well. That's for sure. It may, whatever the result from there, it probably would not have been good way to you know, endear yourself to the locals if it made it seem like you ran him off. So I don't know if that could have been avoided, but clearly things have not gone well since. From Michael Roach, Stu and Bruce, everyone dismissed Herm Edwards' structure for the coaching staff at ASU as a disaster waiting to happen, but he has quietly outperformed expectations so far. While there has been some discussion of their on-field performance in the national media, I haven't seen or heard much about how the specifics of his general manager model have been panning out. I'm curious what your thoughts are a few weeks into year two as to how that structure is working. Is Herm an innovator and the head coach of the future, or was it all mostly hype and it's not looking much different from every other team?
No, I think he's done a really good job as a leader and as a CEO. I think one of the best hires he made, which I don't think is an unconventional one, was making Danny Gonzalez, who's a Rocky Long disciple at San Diego State. They're really good on defense. I think one thing that has been in Herm's favor is the expectations were so low from many of us, and you and I are certainly included in this, because there were so many bizarre moments stemming from his initial press conference with Ray Anderson, where like there's an agent involved, just stuff you don't normally see, and some of the comments he made, so people thought it was going to be a huge disaster. I mean, he's done a very nice job. You and I have both now spoken, I think, and written a little bit about hey, we got it wrong. He's done way better than we thought. The truth is, though, I don't think it's right now. They are 11-7 in his 2 years there. That's not that much better than what Todd Graham had done. They went 7-6 last year. That was pretty much in line with where Todd Graham was. I think the things that to like are, like I said, they're a lot better on defense now, because some of the stuff Todd Graham would do, in you'd hear this from other coaches, it's like it's so unsound that it created some issues that they had to work around. I mean, they had plenty of talent, and it just sometimes it kind of backfired on him. So I don't know if you'll see more of the CEO model. I think, again, I think he's made some very smart moves, and I think his leadership and his perspective has really been refreshing for a lot of people inside that program.
I also think that I know more now about the, kind of the dynamics at ASU, and Michael Crow in particular, the president. Innovation, pretty much everything they do at the university, they sell as we're so innovative and it's going to be a new model. I don't think at the end of the day it's that different a model than any other college football program. They just tried to sell it that way. And like you said, the press, everything about it, the press conference, the way they introduced it was unusual. But how it's actually playing out in reality, I think it's a college football program. He's doing a really good job so far. And he hired a good staff.
I mean, Marvin Lewis there is, as an advisor, there's several former longtime head coaches who are in similar roles in big programs. I mean, Jerry Kill just got a job in Blacksburg not long ago. John Robinson, the USC legend, is now at LSU. There's a lot of guys.
Who was I watching recently? Yeah, who was that? Where's Ron Zook?
Ron Zook saw him on the sideline. Ron Zook is at Maryland with Mike Locke.
That's right. Yeah, that's... I'm not trying to take anything away from ASU. They're doing a great job. I just think we probably made a little too much of the time out of the whole press release and the new model and all of that.
All right, the next question, Stu, is from Jason Chambers. Hey, Stu and Bruce. Are the Big Ten and SEC massaging their schedules to keep teams undefeated late into the season? And do you think that helps them with the playoff committee? And here are some things that Jason points out. Ohio State and Penn State are scheduled for November 23rd. Wisconsin plays Iowa November 9th. Alabama and LSU play in November. Georgia and Auburn play in mid-November. LSU and Auburn play in late October. And Georgia also plays Texas A&M and Florida in November. The Pac-12 does not do this. The Big 12 does not do this. The ACC doesn't have a second team, so they can't do this. Does it provide a competitive advantage? What are your thoughts, Stu?
Well, I have noticed that. Like the fact that Ohio State's playing Penn State and not just Michigan, Penn State and Michigan the last 2 weeks of the season seems different. But if I had to guess, they're doing that for TV more than they're doing it for competitive reasons. You know, that's great. That could make for great ratings for ESPN or Fox, whoever's showing those games. If it's, well, let's say, undefeated Ohio State against one loss Penn State, or even better, undefeated against undefeated that late in the season with the playoff implications on the line, more so than if they were playing this week or in late September. The SEC has generally not done it that way, but again, they seem to be shifting it where, you know, Georgia playing Texas A&M the week before, I believe they're playing the week before the Georgia Tech game at the end of the season, Texas, which means Texas A&M is playing Georgia and LSU the last 2 weeks of the season. So it's starting to get a little bit more backloaded, that's for sure. But if I had to guess, that's more for TV reasons than to make sure you have as many undefeated teams as possible late into the year.
Hey guys, couple of coaching questions. We always hear about the proverbial hot seat. But is there such thing as a cold seat in college football, i.e. where a coach cannot wait to get out of the school where he's at, a la Brett Bielema at Wisconsin, Rich Rod at West Virginia years ago? If Josh Heupel keeps winning at UCF, how long until he gets mentioned for big Power 5 jobs? Thanks, guys. Keep up the great work. From Benoit.
I think that there's some truth to that, that there are coaches who can't wait to get out of where they are. I'm not sure that that was necessarily the case for either of those guys. I think it was more about the opportunities that came up. But you and I hear about coaches who are not happy at their particular school and are hoping to find a way out. Hey, you know who's the king of that? Gary Anderson. he did that not once but twice. Got out of a Power 5 job, and now is back at Utah State. Josh Heupel, I think that at first there was probably some, hey, let's wait and see, because, you know, Scott Frost built this thing, and last year, how much of that was what Frost built versus what Heupel's doing. But if UCF runs the table and goes back to the New Year's Six again this year, at some point you gotta start crediting that to Heupel. So I don't know if the answer is end of this year or another year after that, but no question, the more he keeps winning at UCF, of course he's going to start getting mentioned for those jobs, don't you think?
Yeah, I think, again, it's got to be keep building. And if he can put up a 12-1, or I guess it would be a 13-1 season, that'll continue to rise up on people's radar.
All right. Well, I think that's all the time we have for this week's episode. As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We'll be back on Thursday for the Audible Extra. That's available on the Athletics app. We'll see you next time. If you enjoy the Audible, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Rate and review us. It helps get the word out. By the way, you can also find the Audible now on The Athletic. Go to theathletic.com/theaudible. Our producer is John Hayes. Our theme music is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octaves. You can find their music on Spotify, wherever you get your favorite music from. Follow me, Stu, on Twitter @SLMandel. Follow Bruce @BruceFeldmanCFB. And if you haven't done so already, subscribe to The Athletic. You can try it for free for 7 days at theathletic.com/freetrial. Talk about it for years.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.